Leafs, Tavares, and across the line, in for Marner. Marner swings it in front. O'Reilly scores! Ryan O'Postrophe Riley gets his first in a Leaf uniform. Ryan O'Reilly, the Clinton, Ontario native, gets his first in a Leaf uniform, and he's got another chance in for a goal! Never mind one! O'Postrophe Riley has two! O'Reilly won the draw for the Leafs, who play it high off a stick, and it goes to O'Reilly. O'Reilly with an empty net! Scores! Holy mackinaw! Ryan O'Postrophe Riley will ice this one with his fourth career hat trick.
Woo! What a night. It's the Ryan O'Reilly era. I'm just fired up. We're jazzed up this morning.
The O'Postrophe O'Reilly, it's like, I mean.
It doesn't roll off the tongue.
I don't know how he says it.
But he
was 3 for 3. I don't think I could say that right once.
O'Postrophe O'Reilly.
But like in an enthusiastic tone.
In the moment after watching this guy just steal the hearts of anyone that drives on the QEW, doesn't matter which part. O'Postrophe Riley is creative, it is witty, but it is not easy to say. So shout out Joe Bowen.
Yep.
God, what a night. That was
A big vibes night. That was a big time vibes night.
Yep. Complete opposite vibes from Sunday night's game against the Chicago Blackhawks.
Yeah.
And that was you can really ask for not much more from Ryan O'Reilly.
Three goals, yeah. I mean,
Marner, John Tavares, and co.
Yeah, it was a pretty terrific night. It's a pretty terrific night. It might be a day of eating crow a little bit here on Toronto Sports Radio, though. Weren't we all like in unison being like, yeah, we kind of want to see Ryan O'Reilly on the third line. It's probably the best place for him.
We never said anything of that sort.
Does he really need the soft landing with John Tavares and Mitch Marner? Yeah, maybe he did. 13 combined points. Maybe we'll take a look, extended look at that line moving forward here.
It was pretty incredible. That opening 5 to 10 minutes, if you were a Buffalo Sabres fan, you almost want to leave, I would think.
Watching that garbage start.
There was a point where the Leafs had more goals for an extended period of time than the Sabres had shots.
I don't even think you could, like, do the proper multiplication. Wasn't it 3-0 shots?
It was wild.
At some point, it wasn't even 3-1. It was 3-2-0. It was very, very enjoyable. Very fun first period if you're a Leaf fan.
It lived up to that hype.
But we were talking about how great this game could be and how this rivalry could be renewed. And this could be a very fiery and fire and brimstone type of night with Rasmus Dahlin and Austin Matthews re-engaging their little
Thompson.
Tage Thompson getting going. And it was kind of a wrap after, 5 minutes, it seemed?
Well, I will say the Maple Leafs like to make things interesting. So the third period, that I don't think I felt 100% secure. I was not enjoying them falling a little bit apart.
I guess there was 30 seconds if you wanted to entertain the possibility of a comeback.
More than 30 seconds for me. You thought they played well at the end of the game?
No, but it didn't seem like. It felt like. Okay, so goals came in the third period, clearly.
Yeah,
with exception of Ryan O'Reilly's
second
hat trick.
Second period, the Sabres played better than the Maple Leafs for good stretch. They were putting a lot of pressure on them.
Okay, so they were better in the second and third period, but it was like fake better. It was like in the third period, it was trick shot time where they were trying to hook up Ryan O'Reilly for the hat trick. Clearly, they were trying to get Austin Matthews a goal. Matthews was hitting post, getting robbed by Craig Anderson, who he normally owns. There was how many goals in the third period? Whatever the Sabres got plus O'Reilly, they could have all been Leaf goals based on how it actually played out, but they went Buffalo's way, and it didn't matter because the first period went Toronto's way big time.
Hat trick on his former home ice against the team that said sucked the life out of him wanting to play hockey.
And not just the first time he scored a hat trick there. First time he got a 2-goal game there. He never had a 2-goal game in Buffalo for Buffalo. Comes into with Toronto for the first time, scores 3.
Hats litter the ice on an away game. Every shot of the goal celebrations. It's Leafs fans up on the glass, except for that final shot, which I hope people have seen. It's hilarious. Mm-hmm. Ryan O'Reilly gets that empty netter to secure the hat trick, and there's a kid right behind his head flipping the bird.
It's a lot of anger there.
It's the perfect screenshot. Yeah. It's just, it's amazing.
It wasn't like a friendly flip of the bird.
He
wasn't like, screw you. I wanted to see the Sabres win tonight. It was like, I hate you, Ryan O'Reilly. I hate you.
What percentage of Leaf fans do you think filled that arena? 75?
It felt like 75. I was going to say it felt like 60 and probably was more like 45.
No chance,
They were
Justin.
Just louder and they were dressed
there
up.
There is no chance that there were more Buffalo Sabres fans than Maple Leaf fans.
You don't think?
No chance. I would bet you. I'm not going to put money on it because
I don't want to take that bet either.
100% that there was more Leaf fans than Sabres fans there. The Sabres have one of the worst attendance in the league this year.
The camera's looking for Leaf fans.
And they had finding them.
No, they didn't have any trouble finding
them. The Leafs fans did the wave at the arena.
They weren't showing the pocket of 200 pure Buffalo Sabres fans that were sitting on their hands.
They had to find some Sabres fans for those goals. And they found a few, and they were like a lowly couple, kind of like, yeah.
Yeah, can we get excited?
Go Bills! What's playing on here in this rink? They looked lonely.
I was listening to the Bunkus podcast on the way home yesterday, and apparently they're having trouble selling out.
That's what I'm saying.
I was shocked.
They have some of the worst attendance this year in the league, is what JD was talking to his guests about.
I had no idea that.
So you're telling me that they had more fans than the Maple Leafs last night?
Well, that's a premium game. They might hold on to the tickets for that. Clearly, a lot of them were sold, but I don't know if it was 75% Leaf fans. That seems aggressive.
They were so excited that the Leaf fans were able to start the wave at an opposing arena.
They were able to do that. You're right about that.
Anyway, the amount of hats and the amount of cheering and the fact that there was...
Yeah, the hats lend something to your argument as well. A lot of hats.
The wave was created at an opposing arena. I think there's lots of Leaf fans. Nonetheless, it was a fun one for Leafs Nation, wherever you're watching. And the biggest question going into yesterday was, what are they going to do with this lineup? You know, should Ryan O'Reilly be on the third line? But okay,
that wasn't even like the suggestion. That was the consensus. We're like, okay, that's cute. You had a weekend. Let's be real now.
They still haven't even had a practice though.
No, still haven't had
crazy.
A practice. You know what I liked the most? Obviously, it was great for Ryan O'Reilly. Great to have that moment. His interviews were fantastic. Everything about last night for Ryan O'Reilly was tremendous. But I loved how, okay, that weekend didn't go so great for us, and we want this to be really successful, especially if you're John Tavares and Mitch Marner. And they were so, so good, those two, last night. They were like, oh, we're not going to let this slip. We're not going to let this become a thing. We're going to step up, and we're going to be outstanding. Mitch Marner was easily the best player on the ice. Wasn't even close. Mitch Marner was outstanding. And John Tavares had a couple really, really brilliant moments as well. He was mostly, he did most of the work, is what I'm trying to say, for the William Nylander goal with two brilliant passes and eventually setting him up. So I loved what Ryan O'Reilly's teammates did to help him have such a great night. And I feel like that plays into the vibes thing. Big vibes night. If you can feel that good, let's see how long you can feel that good and see what it looks like.
That's right.
For an extended look.
So, as you mentioned, Mitch Marner could have been one of his best games as a Maple Leaf. He is a man possessed with that puck. The creativity and the vision that he's playing with as of late, and mostly this season, but specifically over the last stretch, he must be one of the most difficult guys to play against right now. Mm-hmm. And he tilts the ice every time he steps out there. He shuts down whatever momentum the other team has, and he's like, okay, I'm going to make unbelievable plays. Unbelievable, the way that he played last night. And Ryan O'Reilly is going to be the story, deservingly so. He gets a hat trick against his former team in his third game as a Maple Leaf, but Mitch Marner deserves just as much credit for what he did last night. And now this trio, the Ontario line, or we're trying to find a name for it. I don't know. I like the Ontario line.
It's pretty easy.
Did you hear Joe Bowen on the intro there giving Clinton a shout out?
Yeah, but there was I don't want to bring up other people's graphics, but there was a little...
There was a controversial moment.
There was a little controversy. Where did they say he was from?
Varna,
Ontario. I don't know where Varna... We're going to have to do some Varna homework.
I know about
homework.
Varna.
You know about Varna? Tell me about Varna.
I think the fact that said Varna was maybe because he was born in Varna. Because there's probably a hospital.
What's the Clinton hospital system like?
I don't think there is like a full-on hospital.
Okay, so he had to go to Varna.
Well, I think there's a case. Let me ask you this. I think there's a difference between your hometown and where you were born.
I suppose. But, like, it shouldn't be birthplace.
It said birthplace.
Like, on your hockey card, it shouldn't be birthplace. It should be hometown.
Varner's just as little and just as hamlet-y.
Yeah, so they got the hospital. They got the hospital over there.
I'm just a bit confused.
That's what I'm saying, though. Do you agree with me? It shouldn't be birthplace. It should be hometown.
I agree.
This is where he's
like,
from.
Like, I was born in a hospital in Newmarket, but I don't classify Newmarket as my hometown.
Your hometown is not Newmarket.
That's
the closest
shout
hospital.
Shout out South Lake Hospital for pushing the baby out, but then I didn't live in Newmarket. Yes. So I think that we just got to decide how we classify people.
We're sticking to Clinton.
Anyway, Clinton legend gets his hat trick. But nonetheless, okay, so this line, 13 combined points, the first time ever in Leafs history that three players had 3 points in the first period, which I was kind of like, oh, yeah.
Sometimes it's sports pretty shocking.
Sometimes Sportsnet staff pulls these things out. I'm like, who is there someone that sits there and knows this, or is it like a bot? Is it one of those like AI chat things that just knows stats? Like, who had that pulled up?
I'm the same way with NBA. It's like, it must be easy, though. You just plug the number in. And it like
easy.
And it like cross references.
I don't understand how they do it.
This one's different. The three players with 3 points.
Yeah.
In one period.
In the first period.
In a first period. So
ever.
I guess I don't know. Is there a system where you go, okay, they all had 3 points, and it's the first period, and you cross reference all first period
data? Those
are
the people that know Microsoft Excel, and then if you lie about it on your resume, you get asked to do it. You don't even know how to make a chart.
There's no one sifting through like and pouring through years
every
and decades of data pages.
I just gotta say, shout out to Sportsnet Stats, because those guys are that human, or I don't know if it robot. It's like
they find a way.
This is the first time in the history of the world that somebody was had a size 12 shoe and also a right-handed twig and was born in the first part of the month of February in the Southern Hemisphere that ever scored with 6 minutes left in the first period. It's like, oh, how did you figure all that out? I don't know.
I kind of think I know, but maybe I have no idea.
Okay.
You just plug in information and it's
they're pretty incredible.
Something. But
13 combined points.
13 combined points.
Most of those in the first period.
And a lot of it is O'Reilly, great night. Marner and Tavares having great nights. Some of it, too, was Buffalo being, like, really, really shoddy defensively. Like, I don't really... We were kind of excited about that group, talking to Andrew Peters yesterday, Samuelson, Dahlin, Owen Power. A lot of things to be excited about on the back end. As much as Toronto's built up front with loaded talent that could be super... like. They are superstars, but that's how they're built. They're kind of built from the back out a little bit there in Buffalo. Yeah, they have Tage Thompson. Yeah, they have some first round draft picks that they've spent on forwards, but the strength and future strength of that team should probably be on defense. And it was like, it was Swiss cheese early. Like, Marner was doing whatever he wanted.
It was
easy for O'Reilly.
Lukanen.
Ukko-Pekka Lukanen.
More like Puka.
But he didn't know what chance did he have really?
Bad joke. No, it was tough.
I was trying to just trudge right through it, but you didn't let me.
Okay, so do you keep them together now? And the easy
answer,
okay, but I know. How could you not? How could you not keep them together after that performance? But then do you not think in the little bit of your mind is like this guy was acquired for center depth. This guy
was he though?
That's what we thought.
I think we can like further question why he was acquired a little bit.
Because of one game.
No, I just think we can continue to like think about it. Cause we kind of like you can put out there like Stanley Cup champion, Conn Smythe Trophy winner, guy who's dominated the Selke voting or at least been part of the dominance for the Selke voting for the last 5 years. Like we get all that, but the assumption was okay, you've got to anchor a dominant third line. I don't know, maybe part of it is hey, we don't necessarily trust John Tavares to be that dominant player in the postseason, right? Like, there can be something there. We were talking about last year how that second line failed them in a lot of ways. John Tavares turned it on at the end of that series, but was not good enough early. It has to be really, really good. We've been talking about John Tavares going to the wing for a while. We've been talking about the last 5, 6, 7 years of that contract since that contract was signed. Maybe they think they need a little bit of a boost on that second line. And to get the best John Tavares, maybe you need to lessen some of the responsibilities.
Yeah,
maybe
and you've
that's
been all over that
reason.
Since the trade about lessening and letting him cook in the playoffs.
And all the credit in the world goes to John Tavares. He's had a great season. but maybe they just want to help him continue to be great.
So I'm not proposing this. I'm just saying it's certainly a consideration now because you've had three games and last night was obviously outstanding. But are you telling me in the playoffs that you don't want to have the opportunity or the option to have three lines of really good center depth where you can shut down the opposing team, a Tampa Bay Lightning team, which we went line for line yesterday. We did that with Boston Bruins. I don't think it's as much of a lock that this is the way it goes for the rest of the season. And I think this is part of the reason that it's a benefit that they got Ryan O'Reilly a little bit early here before the trade deadline, because they can afford to do some experimenting. But after last night, it looks ridiculous to change the lines and be like, well, Ryan O'Reilly is now going to go on a third line because he just, they just had this breakthrough that the passion is back.
Yeah.
The captain line. And someone said the cap, my captain, oh, captain could be the line because there's two captains. I don't know if that one rolls off the tongue as much, but the idea of it is that those three should be untouchable. But I'm just saying, if you just, if you pigeonhole yourself into that and down the line, you need to find a way to make three lines work. I just question a little bit about locking this in right now. And but you, I loved it. Okay. Let you, me just say
you need
that.
You need John Tavares to play center too. Like, you need at least that option.
I mean, Ryan O'Reilly never loses a draw. It's insane.
That
but
too.
Still.
Like, there's value there to win faceoffs and make sure that a scoring line like a Tavares Marner unit has the puck more often than not, that it's not spending the first 30 seconds of the shift chasing the puck. That's very important. So there's a lot that goes into it. I think we should, and I think we were a victim of this after the weekend too. It should not be about the results as much as it should be about the process. The process should be trying to build two different things here. The process should be trying to build that loaded top six, that scoring line, that option where if you are chasing a game or you are playing with a reduced bench, you are, you have that option. You can go nuclear. You can be overwhelming with how much talent you have at the top, but you also have to see the other option.
So that's what I'm saying. I think there should be a little bit of a transitional experimental period.
Exactly.
Here.
This should be a test run. Should
but
it
we're
be,
all going to be like,
be
I can't
games,
believe that they moved around the second line, but think big picture,
well,
everybody.
What was I saying yesterday? I was like, well, I don't love the optics of being like, oh, that didn't work after a, after one weekend with
well,
no practices.
It,
let's put him on
worse.
The third line. No, maybe it looks better now that you're like, okay, you just had this great night. That wasn't about, hey, just trying to catch lightning in the bottle. It was about, hey, we are trying to build something here.
And you
let's
know,
see exactly what we have.
Size.
I would love it if they just line in the sand, five games, we're making the switch despite how good we played. Yeah. Maybe they are even better in game four, even better in game five.
How do you get better than that?
You probably can. But you don't use that as your crutch. You see what could be possible to you, what's available to you, with a third line anchored for Ryan O'Reilly, because guess what? The results for that could be fantastic, too.
Okay, so this question is not just coming out of nowhere. Keefe was asked about the future, long-term future of the second line. I feel like this is going to be a conversation point until we get to Friday, because they don't have a practice again today. They got a day off between the travel, which apparently is like an 18-minute flight, which is hilarious.
I love that.
It's like, you don't even put
how
your
how high do you actually go for 18
I don't know,
minutes.
Like just high enough to cross over the CN Tower. And the bridge, which one is it? Is it Peace or Lewiston or they have to go over some bridge.
I don't even want to
over Niagara Falls.
Peace? I think it's Peace.
It's one of those. Okay. So here's Keefe on the long-term future of the second line.
I didn't put any sort of timeline on it other than, you know, to just to say that I wasn't going to do it for one or two games. I think we, you know, we owe it to the line to spend some time, some real time together. You know, it would have been easy the other night after a loss, and maybe it didn't go so great to break it up. But, you know, I feel like our third and fourth lines have been so good. It's, there's lots of reasons to just stay with it, and felt like they were close. So I think it's a good sample of what we're capable of. You know, I still feel at the end of the day, you know, we're going to have John back in center and all those kind of things. But it's, you know, you want to build chemistry and you want to build confidence that if and when you go to it, that that's what it's capable of.
All right, so the options are out there. And
it's
that's a really
enough.
Nice treat to have, right?
I think another part of this is, okay, they looked great. Do you really want to demote in quotes, Ryan O'Reilly? The bottom six looks really good, too.
Okay, Nolan Chari is, we got to put some respect again on this guy. Like, it's been the Ryan O'Reilly trade, but this guy's awesome.
And it looks like he's pulling something out of Zach Aston Reese,
too.
Yes,
he's
like those two guys are
kind of
Bash brothers all of a sudden. Aston Reese only had, I think, three hits in the game.
I thought he had like six.
It looked like he should have been given more. but Nolichari had 7 in the game. And that's what we're looking for.
I thought you meant Nolichari. Nolichari had at least 6.
I think he only had 3. But they're throwing their body around. Like, they're making their presence felt when they're out there. Suddenly, that fourth line looks at like it has major utility. And I guess you change the dynamic of that fourth line inadvertently if you change the dynamic of the second line. Because if you drop Ryan O'Reilly down, that means David Camp is going to the fourth line. That means Nolichari is shifted to the wing. And maybe that's not necessarily a bad thing. But right now, the bottom 6 looks really good. And maybe you're going to be left something to be desired with that third line moving forward. Maybe David Kampf isn't who I believe he is in a playoff series. And maybe Yarncroke and Engvall don't give you much utility. That's just a maybe. That's like, I doubt it.
It's a maybe.
I doubt it. I think he'll be fine. But I'm not rushing to change the mix right now in the bottom 6 either, because it has been really, really good. It has been very, very different. It looks like it can finally give you something rather than you're holding your breath every time they're out there because you're just hoping that they don't undo the progress that the top 6 has already made in the game.
So I like that Sheldon Keefe kind of, he didn't say there's a timeline on it, but he said, you know, I think John Tavares will be back playing center. So tiptoeing into the idea that Morgan Riley, man, I need apostrophe. Opostrophe Riley might shift to that third line, and I think we just can't use the word demotion because it's basically a promotion because you get your own line now, buddy.
That's something of a spin, I would say.
Hey, I'm all about the spin. Okay.
But why would Ryan O'Reilly just assume?
And why would Ryan O'Reilly not want to play with Mitch Marner and John Tavares after that? Because he's like, hey, I'm a UFA and I just got a hat trick and 4 points. And
yeah, but he's a Leaf, though.
It's real hot.
Don't you think watching that game, you're like, he's sticking around?
Oh,
all the interviews.
I felt that since we spoke to Brian
O'Reilly. Brian O'Reilly, that was the tell. It's happening.
Hey,
but he just oozes Leafdom.
Every time
he's talking, it's like, that's a Leaf and a future Leaf and a current Leaf. There's no way. There's no way he's leaving. They got to find a way to keep him around.
I got a great tweet last night from Kate. Hey, Ailish, segment idea. Mama and or Papa O'Reilly react to Leaf games. Intro music should be obvious. Really, I just want to know who can joyfully use the most cuss words after tonight. It's very cute.
Yeah, we'll have a little talk with Brian next time before the next one.
Whatever. We didn't get any complaints.
No.
Okay, anything else from that game? I didn't really love the end, not to make a negative out of it, but, you know, it's one of those games where you're up 5-0. It's early. You can't let your foot off the gas. I just didn't like some of the goals that Samsonov let in, and that's fine because they found a way to win, and it wasn't, like, hairy, but, you know.
I thought it was more about Samsonov than anything else. Like, I do think the Leafs were kind of
a couple defensive laps.
They were hunting for points a little bit. I think they were feeling themselves, and they kind of like, okay, they gave up some, I wouldn't even say odd man rushes, just some transition opportunities for Buffalo, and they scored on them. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Samsonov could have had a couple of them.
Sure.
Maybe it wasn't a terrific close to the game for Samsonov, but he also kept them off the board until the third period, right?
Just things I thought from the game.
It happens. In 5-0 games, it happens.
Anything else from it?
No.
All right. I don't think so. Jeff Merrick at 8. Sorry. Jeff Merrick at 7. And then our buddy Brent Gunning, not Carl Gunnarsson, but another Gunner, joining us at 8 a.m. And then we're going to have Mark Anthony Kay from your TFC and Team Canada at 8:30. And then we'll do a little question period during your 7:30 block.
One more quick thing before we transition.
Yes.
If Austin Matthews just like starts seeing the puck go in the net, this team could be.
There was a point during the last night's game where I was like, is Austin Matthews playing?
Really?
Yeah.
Because I thought he was great in the second half.
The first half
Nylander,
of this game.
Nylander and Matthews have been quiet throughout
this
stretch since O'Reilly came aboard. I think they've been a little quiet. Austin Matthews, and I think you can excuse him for Sunday night. I mean, just came back from injury. He was talking about his conditioning Saturday night. Then he has to play the second half of back-to-back. Maybe he was a little slow to start in this game, but when he gets going, and there were flashes of like, oh, he almost got one.
I think he's kind of wanting one when he sees Ryan O'Reilly get three goals, and internal competition is great for that
as well. But I think once he gets back up to speed, if they do keep that top 6 as is, I mean, you can't really compare it to many other teams across the league. It is spectacularly talented, and Matthews is still the best player on this team, and he's taken a back seat to several players on this team so far this season.
I think we're all about small sample size sometimes in Leafs Nation, Twitter and co. Last night was one of the most positive evenings in terms of this team is going to do something different. This is a different Leafs team. So it's just nice to bask in that.
Look at you. You got a little smile,
hours.
Like a little twinkle in your eye while you're saying that.
I mean,
you believe it.
I will believe it today.
Just for today?
No. I think that there was something different about that team. But once again, small sample sizes.
There was something different.
They play one game.
There was something different about how you said that. I think you want to.
I would love to believe.
I think if it wasn't for the past failure, you'd be like, this team's winning the Stanley Cup.
Well, I mean, it's funny because everyone likes to crap on Leafs fans. Oh, you guys are playing in the parade. It's like, let us have one thing. Ryan O'Reilly gets a hat trick against his old team. The Leafs absolutely steamroll the Sabres in a rivalry QEW series. And yeah, it's nice to be happy, okay?
sorry for calling you out on your happiness there.
I'll just be miserable. All right, we got lots of fun things to talk about today, but we teased this last week that we are going to watch episode 1 and 2 of Full Swing, the new Netflix documentary about PGA and a little bit of Liv, which will tiptoe its way into the discussion, but not really these first two episodes.
Wait, so. Liv tiptoes?
Not in the first two episodes, I meant.
Oh, okay. Nice couple teases, eh?
We're gonna be breaking down the new show. If you haven't taken a look at it, you'll have to get Netflix.
I recovered my family's password, by the way.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I'm not locked out yet.
Sneaky sneak.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Figured out a way.
So we watched both episode 1 and 2. Episode 1 called Frenemies and episode 2 called Win or Go Home. And this also happened yesterday during the announcement that Live Golfers will also be eligible for the 151st Open Championship. We'll also see them at the Masters. And this little integration of two rival leagues is going to continue to make its way onto
our screen. It's going to play out at the biggest events, two of the bigger, mm-hmm. biggest events of the golf season. Just quickly on that before we get into Full Swing. I do kind of hate that Liv players can have their cake and eat it too. Like, clearly they're getting exactly what they want. They just want to play majors and they just want to hang out at their country clubs, going across the world and making a ton of money. Like, they're going to have it all other than the opportunity to play at the PGA Championship. I don't know if they're going to be allowed at the US Open.
I don't know if that one's confirmed.
Clearly not the PGA Championship, but they're going to be at least at 50% of the majors. And for them, that's a massive win. But I can't lie. Like, I want them there. Of course you want them there. I mean, we're talking about, why are we watching Full Swing if we don't want them there? It's about the storylines. It's about the drama, the intrigue. If they're not there, the tournament is lesser than. And for that reason, it sucks that they get exactly what they want and they can do whatever they want. They can threaten golf's future. But if we're looking for the best entertainment product, which we are at the Open and at the Masters, we're getting it with the Liv players there.
Yeah, we are, and we didn't really get too much of that in episode 1 and 2. This was obviously filmed last year, and mm-hmm. so there are some teases as the season goes on.
They are bouncing around, though. They could be there. I mean, that's what kind of, like, confused me, because they did the PGA Championship.
It's not chronological.
No, because they did the PGA Championship, and apparently we're getting the whole Mito Pereira story later, I think, in one of the episodes. But the PGA Championship was all about Mito Pereira, rather, and they made it about Justin Thomas. And then all of a sudden, we're back at the Waste Management Open, which is one of the first. So we'll go through both of them, but, like, they can tell that Liv story whenever they want, but clearly they're building toward it.
Okay. So let's go episode for episode. So number one is called Frenemies, and it's about the PGA Championship, of course. And the storyline becomes Justin Thomas versus Jordan Spieth. Mm-hmm. And it's about their friendship. And their the competitive side, which is why it's called Frenemies. And I thought it was really nice to see, I guess, like, the little brother feel, in a sense, of JT. Mm-hmm. That he had to kind of over... Like, I didn't feel bad for him, but I felt... I really was rooting for him.
You gotta check yourself, eh? Like, you can't feel bad for guys that jump on private planes.
100%.
And go to the...
It's a different world, but yeah. I felt for him, and I was really almost proud to see him overcome this big hurdle, which was win the PGA Championship there. And I don't know. It's hard to break these down because they're little, like, tidbits into their relationship and their life. And obviously Jordan Spieth has had, like, the incredible start to his career. Mm-hmm. And then now it's Justin Thomas coming up and they've just had different trajectories. And their relationship is what, for me, was really interesting. They obviously grew up playing golf together. They've had this head-to-head basically their whole life. And one started out with a really red-hot career. And that's got to be really difficult to be the little brother, in a sense. Like, you're not getting the same success. And to find a way through that. In terms of just, we watched two episodes. And if I'm trying to wrap them together and take one thing first of all from it, is the mental game of golfers is kind of what I thought set them apart when you looked at the four that we really get into.
Yeah, definitely.
And that, I saw that a lot with the way that the self-talk with like Justin Thomas and what he has to like push himself in his relationship with his dad. And I think I learned a lot, maybe because the athlete background of me is how golfers talk to themselves is crazy.
I think it like kind of underscores the loneliness of it because you can't rely on, hey, you know, if you're Ryan O'Reilly, you didn't have to do it all yourself out there. You had Mitch Marner passing you the puck and you were put in a great position. With Thomas, like I think the scenes after the third round where he had a brutal round and could not find himself and was distraught and miserable and could not figure out what was wrong with him. Then he shows up the next day, finds something, goes like, has a legendary round, but still needs all the help in the world from Mito Pereira to put himself in that position. But how quickly things can turn, how one shot changes everything. And you're right, the mental game, it's like, it seems like everything's always on like a wire, right? What's the circus? What do they walk down?
Tightrope.
It's like they're always on that because one mistake could have things unravel so quickly. And I think the best thing about this series so far is definitely to look into the minds of these players and how fragile everything really is. But I think another thing, if it's fragility and it's like the mental thing, I think how fleeting, if we were looking at two episodes, how fleeting golf is, how fleeting the entire, the careers of these players really are, because you laid it out. Jordan Spieth had that amazing start and Justin Thomas is still trying to catch him, but who would you rather be right now? Justin Thomas.
That's right.
If we're looking at these two players right now, Justin Thomas is the one that's top five in terms of favorites every weekend that he plays, while Jordan Spieth, he's sometimes there and he can win still and he has great rounds and he has great tournaments, but sometimes he's just a complete mess and he's not the one that you would bank on to be good week in and week out, at least compared to Justin Thomas. Justin Thomas has overtaken him, but he still has so much work to do to catch what Jordan Spieth did early in his career. So there was a window in time where Jordan Spieth was the guy. Justin Thomas, I think, still trying to capture that moment where he's the guy for an extended period of time. John Rahm right now is that guy, winning, what, half the starts that he's had so far this year. And then it goes to Brooks Koepka, who was, like Jordan Spieth, on top of the world, could not lose, was the alpha for a specific time period, and now cannot find himself and doesn't know how to deal with the fact that he's not the alpha anymore. He is mentally broken, at least it seems, in this documentary, because he can't capture the form he once had. And I think it just kind of underscores how like incredible Tiger Woods was. He never had these lulls. All these players that we just went through had these lulls where they were great and now they're not so great. Tiger was always great. Even guys like Charles Howell III that have been around forever, won so much money on tour, were never at Tiger's level, were never at Brooks or Jordan's or Justin Thomas's level, but just could play golf at a high level for so long because it's hard to do.
So in the two episode sample size that we're going to talk about today, you're right. I think it's about capturing lightning in a bottle and living in that moment where you're at your best.
Maximizing
because,
it.
Because we see Scottie Scheffler in the second episode, who is absolutely, he wins three out of his five in a row. He goes from just debuting to being number one. And he is living in this moment. And I just really liked how he talks about what golf means to him. And he's like, I enjoy playing golf and I leave it there. And he's able to kind of just detract and go home and not like let it come home with him and carry into his life. And on the other side of it, you're cross-referencing with Brooks, who is really, as you mentioned, struggling. And he's talking about it like, I'm not going to diagnose him, but he's mentally fragile about how difficult this transition has been, because all he says is, I've got a taste for winning and that's all I want. It's only about winning. He's got a trophy wall with empty spots where he wants to put his trophies that he hasn't won yet. And he looks at them every day and he thinks, that's where I need to win. I need to win. I need to win. And
just to interrupt you quickly, the best part of that we saw in the first two episodes, I think, was him unable to listen to his wife talk about or his wife-to-be talk about, you know, the silly Brooks thing, the future Miss Koepka, and the see-through bikini thing that he can't even pay attention to her because he's so distraught with how he's been playing. And that kind of runs counter to what we think Brooks Koepka is. We think he doesn't care. That was kind of the narrative around him. He just, this guy's, yeah, he's so talented, but he only cares a couple tournaments of the year, and he's never going to really work as hard as everybody else. He's just naturally talented, and that's good enough for him to win sometimes. But clearly, like, this haunts him. The fact that he's not the best is haunting him in that moment. And just, I'll let you finish your point here, but I think that's what we learned. That's what I learned the most, is that Brooks isn't the person that we thought. He's like almost damaged by the fact that he's not the best anymore. Mm-hmm. And that window into his life and running, and that juxtaposition to Scottie Scheffler's life, where he's just like happy eating corn chips and getting coffee with his wife and really doesn't care about anything but God and what's at home, that allows him to be free and easy and just have success on the golf course.
I guess for me, I wrote down this phrase that one of the commentators said. He was having a crisis of confidence. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how I viewed this look into what Brooks Koepka was dealing with. You mentioned he's incredibly talented. He says to himself, I can win all of these tournaments. I just don't know why I'm not. And he said he felt embarrassed leaving. The Masters. Yeah, it was the Masters. He felt embarrassed leaving. He said he's never felt that way. So I watched this thinking, I understand why he went to live. Because the chapter had closed, it felt like, for him.
But also the trophy case. That trophy case is going to stay closed because he went to live.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he gets to play in the tournament that we just outlined.
But I think it got to a point, and he said, I can't compete day in and day out with these guys. Like, he shuts himself out of the competition just with his, like, self-talk. And for him, at the end of the episode, there's a cliffhanger where the producer goes, well, you know, what are you thinking about this live golf thing? Like, something interests you. And he has this little smirk, and then the episode ends. And you're like, okay. But the way they set that up, and it's all produced, obviously. Like, this is like reality TV. Obviously, they go and they try to create a storyline from it. They're asking, you know, Jordan and Justin to talk about their future and then to go on the course and place bets against each other. Like, they create these stories, but Brooks doesn't have to be as forthright and honest about how much he's struggling. He doesn't have to have these moments where he's at the pool pit beside his giant walk-in pool and his hot future wife is prancing around a bikini and he can't even focus on her. Like, that's real. I don't think he's acting.
I mean, it's a bit insightful
into, as you said, what he's struggling with, because golf is his life.
You can exaggerate it for sure. Mm-hmm. But, and that's a key thing that you just said there. Golf is his life. And I think the narrative on Brooks was that golf was far from his life, that he didn't actually love it.
Okay, he loved the lifestyle. Learning from this.
That he loved the lifestyle. And I don't want to like rationalize his decision to go to live. But it
feels
like...
Do you not understand it more? It
feels like he needed to go to live to cope.
Yeah.
Honestly. He needed to like justify who he was as a golfer or as an athlete, because he couldn't stand... He's still, you know, top 1% of the 1% of people playing golf, but he's not the very best. And he had no other... I don't think he just could not handle it anymore. Could not handle not being that guy, and ran away for the money and ran away from the spotlight in a lot of ways. And now he can just... I don't think... And that's the best part of this episode was like the scene that he was in, the pool that you mentioned, the house, the wall of Jordan's,
that Nike wall.
This guy, wife, this guy clearly has everything.
He's everything.
Everything.
But and it's
he's,
not enough.
And he's unhappy and it's not enough. And I think he's running towards more shoes, more pools, more whatever with the live world. But will that ever make him happy? The trophy case might be the only thing that makes him happy if it was complete, and it will stay incomplete. So I think I loved that episode. I thought the juxtaposition between Scheffler and Brooks was way better than anyone gave it credit for or the series credit for. I was like, oh, sure, we want to do this because people don't really love it. But that episode was awesome. It was very, very good.
It was better for me than episode one because I felt like I kind of knew the Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas story. And it was heartwarming to see these guys go, you know, grow up together and go head to head. I thought
That was just like selling the dream, right? Like that's like, oh, you watch it with your buddy and be like, oh, that could have been us,
sweet,
dude.
Eh?
That could have been us. We could have been on the private plane to Tulsa playing tune-up rounds for a major championship and gambling away $100 a hole. Like that's what anyone who plays golf is like, yeah, that's the dream. So they're showing you the dream. And then the next episode, they're showing you the torment versus versus Scottie Scheffler, who probably just stumbled into all this and would rather complain on the Masters, while winning the Masters, about his wife eating popcorn in bed. And that's what's going through his head in the moment. Well, Brooks is this tormented individual who can't handle his reality after being on top of the world for so long. I thought it was great.
So two episode sample size. Once again, we're going to continue doing this. I thought the realities of Justin Thomas in CVS could not have been more relatable. As someone that went to CVS basically every other day when I lived in the United States.
Every other day?
Well, it was like right beside our, like it was like on campus. You always need something from CVS.
Okay.
Pedialyte.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know? I laugh so hard watching this guy try to navigate CVS, try to use the self-checkout when it's like, your card is not accessible.
Your head's exploding from allergies and you can't get your
flying
credit card
out, and he has to do this. It looks like this guy's never had to shop for himself too. It's funny because he's like, I gotta go in there. Where's the allergy aisle? And then he's trying to self-check out and he can't figure out the machine. It was fun to see these little moments. And that's and my big question here is, what is the point of Full Swing? Because the F1 Drive to Survive was not only showing people a sport that I think we can all admit was not getting the amount of coverage or interest that worldwide, that in North America at least. And look at how many people, myself included, care about F1 now because this was a successful documentary. Not only do you know about the sport, which I didn't, not only now do you know about these mega billionaires that own these clubs and what goes into how hard it is to be an F1 driver, how hard it is to have this car, which needs to be immaculate. You can't have any mistakes. The life, the trials and tribulations of being an F1 driver and everything goes on behind the scenes. I thought it was a perfect introduction into F1. Now with Full Swing, I wonder if they're trying to chase a similar process of, hey, maybe you don't know anything about golf. Like, there are some times...
Well, I almost turned it off when Amanda Renner was like, okay, so, yeah, they play twice, Thursday and Friday.
But then I thought about that, too.
The lowest score wins. I was just like, oh,
I'm out. But you know about golf. And I know about golf. And there's probably people that are flipping this on that don't know about golf. So they're trying to bridge a very tough, maybe a duality of watchers that are viewers that have no idea about golf. That are like, this looks fun.
Well, think about the Amazon Prime, too. With the Leafs, it was just like, oh, this is very surface level. And it's just like, if you're a Leaf fan, this might not be for you. It's for someone in Spain that's never seen hockey played before. And it's like, oh, I could watch this. So, it's for a global audience. And this, I think, can balance it really good because you taught me something about Brooks Koepka with this. And not only did you do that, but you introduced the PGA Tour and golf to like massive millions and millions of people.
I'm just saying it's going to be difficult, I think. And this is probably part of the struggle of producing this, is there's a lot more people in our world here maybe that know the basics of golf. Like, I understand what it is to move up and down the leaderboard. So not just focusing on the in-depths of these relationships, but also you have to have a baseline of like, this is golf, because people might not know it. So I think there might be moments that we find a little cringy that we're like, I understand what, you know, what the tee box is, or like, you know.
I mean, to me, it more than made up for it with the
100%.
With the Brooks stuff.
But I felt when I watched Drive to Survive that I had no introductory knowledge. And so everything for me was like, oh, that makes so much sense. Oh, I had no idea about you have to change the tires every whatever. Like,
you need some base level, though. Like, for the live stuff...
We also cover sports for a living, so...
But, like, if it weren't for the live context, the Brooks narrative or storyline wouldn't have been as good, because you know he gets driven...
I still think it would have been good.
He gets driven off the edge. This thing drove him to a different league. And I think knowing that and understanding live, you could just be like, oh, it's another golf league, who cares? No, it's pretty, it threatened.
And I wonder how they get into this.
It threatened
too.
The foundation for which golf walks on is live. Yeah. It's not just like, hey, he went to play, you know, he started his career in Sweden and then he went to Finland to play. Like, it's not that. It's way bigger than that. And any golf fan would understand that. And I think for that reason, it's probably made for just about everyone, because I think there was something for everyone in the first two episodes.
And a great contrast between the two of them. And so we'll do this every week. We'll watch two and we'll break them down.
You want to do it Friday?
Sure,
whatever. Kind of fired up. I'm kind of fired up for golf now.
I actually, yeah.
Put in a lot of bets for the Honda Classic.
I'm fired up.
I'm ready for golf season now.
There's one later in the show, and I forget. Somebody, D was telling us yesterday that you're going to fall in love with this golfer. What's his name?
Joel Damon.
Yes. And they gave you a little tidbit of him, and I can't wait. Because now, people I've talked to about Full Swing say this guy's my favorite golfer now.
There you go.
So lots to look forward to. We'll break that down. But
I did hear that the Brooks episode was the best after I'd watched it.
Great, so it's we like, shouldn't even bother.
But I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it because people were down on it and it was like, it's not that good. I honestly thought the Brooks Koepka story was more than I thought I was going to get out of the series on the first day I watched.
Perfect.
Which was great.
We'll talk to Brent Gunning, who also is a co-host of Leafs Nation and the golf show, which is back. So it's perfect timing. We'll ask him about it if he watched it and if this Brooks investigation of his life of his life helped with some understanding of why he made this decision and
Liv
where he is.
Back this weekend, too. We'll see Brooks
Liv
on the
back.
Course.
Liv is back. I'm excited. I thought so far it's impressed more than I think I was expecting.
Agreed.
So. Okay, just a two episode sample size, though, so we'll see. On the other side of the break, we got the A-list, followed by Jeff Merrick. Did you hear that the St. Louis Blues might now be in on Timo Meier? Okay.
I love it.
We'll get to him after the A-list.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Now it's time for the A-list.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
What's up, baby?
Are you a big March Madness guy?
Can you be a big March Madness guy if you don't watch a single game of NCAA basketball before?
That's why you'd only be a big March Madness guy. You're not
then
a big
I guess so.
February fan. It's March Madness.
I'm not a big February fan, no.
All right, you can be a big March. I have no shame in being a big March Madness guy.
And then not caring.
Watching the rest of the season.
So you're into the tournament, that's it. We're in the same boat?
I'm not going to pretend that I watch every single Virginia Tech game.
Okay, good.
But there
Is
was
Virginia
a reason.
Virginia Tech your team?
Well, there was a reason to watch Virginia Tech last
okay,
night.
Okay, let's hear it.
They lost, but they won, and this is why.
Now, we got to get this here. After Jordan Miller missed that free throw, the crowd's going nuts. Here's why. If he misses the second one, everybody in this house gets free bacon. Bacon for everybody! Sizzled up in the frying pan!
Bacon for everyone!
How do you get everyone bacon?
I think when you leave, you either get a voucher or you get a pack of bacon. And bacon is not cheap. I went to buy bacon the other day.
A pack of bacon is a disaster. Like,
it's got to be a voucher because, like, obviously you're not keeping bacon, like...
Yeah, that was a moron comment on my part. Like, clearly it's a voucher. It's not a packet of bacon.
Like, they just have it in coolers? It's got to be a voucher for bacon.
And it's not like a strip on your way out.
No. But did you hear how excited that crowd was? That got me jazzed up for college sports.
You know what I like once a year?
Free bacon?
No, NCAA basketball. You know what I like every month of the year?
Bacon.
Bacon.
Exactly. I would definitely be into giving away free bacon at a Leafs game or something. We do give away like Popeyes or Pizza.
Instead of throwing shirts, you're throwing packs of bacon?
Just slap someone in the face with some raw bacon.
Yeah, bacon. A pack of bacon has good slapping ability.
Bacon ain't cheap, though.
I was
at the grocery store and it's... There's, you know what? I'll say there's.
I might be done with bacon at least buying it.
It's getting a bit outrageous.
It's outrageous.
There's that cheap one, you know, and it's about as thin as a sheet of paper, and you put that in your frying pan, and it just becomes nothing. And it's really not great. So you have to buy the one step up bacon, and that's like at least $9.99, $12.99 at some stores. You got to look for your coupon days, but bacon isn't cheap. So, and these Virginia Tech students, we're living on student budget.
Might be the one time they have bacon all year.
So congratulations. Proud of them for their bacon, but they did lose, but whatever, they're winners. Brad Marchand, we love when he goes on social media and pokes the fire, right? So there was a post online, quote, update, Seattle, Detroit, and Edmonton seem to be the front runners to host the 2025 NHL All-Star Game.
Three different cities,
very
by the way.
Strange. Like, you couldn't have picked three random team like locations from a hat.
Yeah.
Across the continent, truly.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. He comments on this very public social media post. LOL, can't wait to see how many guys boycott that game.
He's just like, he can't help himself, eh?
Then somebody screenshots and goes, Brad is back at it. And he quote tweets that saying, I mean, it's true. Mm-hmm. So here we are about the discussion of the NHL All-Star game.
Why I say they're different, like Seattle wouldn't be bad, would it?
No,
Seattle's not Edmonton.
I think there's a reason why all three of these could work, sure.
Edmonton has beautiful facilities. Is it going to
impeccable.
Be... is it Florida? No.
They have superstars that play for their team. And
yeah,
they have a great hockey environment.
And I don't know if that gets you an All-Star game, because they're going anyway.
Mm-hmm. But their fans are good.
It's strange, because all we've heard is like, yeah, they're going to have just big cities or warm weather climate. And Toronto's a big city. It's getting it. And Florida
no, I thought,
and Vegas
I thought the
have
word
the last
was
one.
Hockey city.
Hockey city.
Detroit.
Okay, Detroit's original. A hockey city. Edmonton's mm-hmm. a hockey city, but Winnipeg's a hockey city.
Brad Marchand will not be going, is all I got to say. He does not want to attend said All-Star game.
No, and that's okay, but like, we can't, I don't know. Do I really clutch in the pearls for the All-Star game? I'm not really sure if I care that much, but it would be nice if he didn't already feed that already existing thing, that animal that's...
Don't even bother with it.
Like, just...
He
just,
said the players don't want
just
it.
Just shut up and don't go, Brad.
All right. Probably won't talk to Jeff Merrick about that, but he would know. The
I mean,
rumors.
We could ask him.
Nah, we got bigger fish to fry.
Okay.
Bigger bacon in the pan. Jeff Merrick on the other side of the break.